www.dailymusicbreak.com. Visit for great music and free newsletters. Today, we are very pleased to welcome back Scott Yanow, who's a leading jazz writer. Scott, as we did when we talked with you about Louis Armstrong a couple of months ago, could you please fill in the folks on what you've written, some of the books, and where you're posting things, and tell people where to find them to read?
Oh, sure. Well, so thanks for having me back. Let's see. I've written 11 books on jazz, and you could find out more information about that just by going to my website, which is scottyanow.com, scottyanow.com. I knew no one else would take that one. And my most recent one is on jazz guitarists, the great jazz guitarists, and the one before that was on jazz vocalists. So it's called the Jazz Singers. And I've also written a book that's somewhat relevant to the topic of today, because it's called Bebop. And in addition, I write for five magazines: Downbeat Jazz's, the Jazz Rag out of England, Jazz Inside out of New York, and LA Jazz Scene. And write liner notes and just enjoy my life listening to great music all the time.
Great. Well, that's terrific. Appreciate you, joining us and spending some time. Actually, there was one leftover question from our previous conversations, more of a general question. I was kicking myself for not asking it. When jazz folks say that something swings, what do they mean? Obviously, it means it's good, but is it possible to define that concept a little bit more closely or a little bit more granular way?
Well, like so many other aspects of jazz, it's really hard to define. But I think, when something's swinging, that gives you the desire to tap your feet to the beat or to move your body, really. It's swinging. A lot of it has to do with just the placement of notes and also quite often having a string bass that's playing on the beat. So it's the syncopations, really.
Okay.
And that's about as vague as I could be, I think.
I always, it just seems like something. It's like when you see it or when you hear it, And I've heard the term, and I thought it would be a good question to start off with. But today the topic at hand is Charlie Parker and bebop. As I asked you, Scott, with Armstrong, what was the historical point where things were when Charlie Parker was growing up, when he first became, I guess, a young musician? Where was music at that point?
Well, at least American popular music was very much in the swing era. If you're talking about the 1930s, whether it was big bands, which were very popular and surprisingly, really, in retrospect, that so many big bands had hits that one that was selling extremely well, they'd be on the charts. But even small groups, so they tended to be swing-oriented. And Charlie Parker learned from what he heard in Kansas City, and he was pretty influenced by Lester Young and by the Count Basie band and the blues and the music that was around at the time.
Mm-hmm. What was Kansas City's a special place in the history of jazz, and not only because Charlie Parker grew up there, but there's Big Joe Turner and Count Basie. Kansas City is very important. Could you address what Kansas City meant to jazz for a second, Scott?
Well, Kansas City was kind of a unique place at the time because it was even in the early 30s when Prohibition was in force and liquor was allegedly against the law in the United States. Liquor flowed pretty freely in Kansas City. It was run by gangsters basically, but it was gangsters who enjoyed jazz, and because of that, they had an awful lot of clubs that featured musicians playing around the clock. So they had after hours places, and they also had jam sessions that seemed to be on almost a nightly basis. So it gave an environment where jazz was everywhere. You know, that it's only been true a few times in jazz history, and it's always been very good, whether it's 42nd Street in New York or Central Avenue in L.A. So Kansas City had that from pretty much late 20s up until maybe the mid-40s or so. It was pretty much an open environment where the music was being played constantly. I don't think they were being paid very much, but they were certainly playing all the time. And, you know, if you want to become a great jazz musician and you have the talent, if you just play all the time, you'll certainly get on a pretty high level.
Mm-hmm. So Charlie Parker might not have become the kind of the revolutionary figure he was if he had not been in Kansas City.
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, if he were born in a different country or a different situation, he might not have played music at all. Really, but it was one of maybe four or five perfect situations where he could be. And Kansas City just gave him the opportunity to be surrounded by music all the time and to be playing it constantly.
Mm-hmm. I think now's the best time in the conversation to back off from Charlie Parker per se for a second and talk about bebop and what bebop is. And I've wanted to do this with you for a long time. If we take a popular song, and for some reason the song Somewhere Over the Rainbow just sticks in my mind for doing this, I guess because everyone knows it. Everybody is familiar with Somewhere Over the Rainbow, you know, Judy Garland, spinning houses, very scary, flying monkeys, the whole thing. How does a bebop player, how would they approach that song differently than, say, the version that we're all familiar with? What would characterize a bebop version of Somewhere Over the Rainbow?
Well, if it were the classic bebop, you know, as opposed to maybe later on, but someone from, say, mid to late 40s, a more typical version, you know, they would play the melody somewhat straight during the first chorus, and then you wouldn't hear the melody again until the end of the three-minute version, really, because the musicians would be improvising off of the chord changes. They'd be making up their own melodies and their own ideas based on it. And if someone who wasn't familiar with bop was just given the performance and someone put it on in the middle of the song, they might have trouble telling what song it was.
Mm-hmm.
Unless, you know, they were still familiar with the chord changes. But if it were done in the more typical bop-oriented version of that time period, people would go around saying, where's the melody?
Right. So I guess that's what I wanted to touch on for a layperson such as myself. When you have a song, when there's a song, obviously there's a bunch of chords that are hit. So what the bebop people would do, they would play it kind of straight, as you said, the first chorus. And then they would improvise, but they would keep the chord sequences in order. So the chords, almost like the framing of the house would remain, but the wallpaper would all be different,
mm-hmm.
kind of thing?
Yeah, very much. I mean, you know, they might have altered the chords a little bit to begin with to make it more modern, but basically they would stick to the chord changes throughout the song, you know, for that time period, because it wasn't to the point yet where they were playing a lot freer than, you know, something that would come in the late 50s and 60s. But in the late 40s, it was just radical enough to be doing a song like that, maybe at a faster tempo than expected with unusual rhythms, but basically not really playing the melody after you play it at the very beginning. You might hint at it, but that's about it.
Okay, I'm going to ask you later what came after, you know, these first bebop people after this breakthrough. So I think I get it now. So you keep the chords, but you change a lot of other things. And does the tempo usually stay the same?
Well, generally, whatever the tempo is at the beginning, it stays throughout it. And of course, we're thinking more of 3 or 4 minute performances, because in that time period, they were still recording on 78s. I mean, it changed in the 50s. But even then, until someone like Charles Mingus came up, generally the tempo stayed the same.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What role, getting back, I appreciate that kind of interlude there, and I always wondered about these questions. Bring it back to Parker. What specific, obviously nothing happens, one person doesn't do anything, I mean, alone. Einstein didn't, Louis Armstrong didn't, no one does, and neither did Charlie Parker. But what role did Parker play in bebop becoming a popular form of jazz.
Well, Charlie Parker was, very gifted. I mean, at the very beginning, he had a little difficulty in Kansas City jam sessions because he had ideas that he couldn't quite play yet. So he didn't quite have it together. But once he really worked on it, he became so skilled that he could play perfectly coherent solos at remarkable tempos, and every note would fit. If you listen to some of his fastest records and you put it on a record player and put it at half speed, you notice that every note fits, basically. So he was able to think that quickly. He came up with a wide variety of original phrases that became basically the vocabulary of jazz, particularly, after he came up in the mid-40s, by the 50s, other musicians were studying everything he played. And the thing about Charlie Parker is that he actually wasn't quite as radical in his choice of notes as someone like Dizzy Gillespie. Dizzy Gillespie, the great trumpeter, he had the ability to play notes that were completely wrong and hold them, and somehow he made them fit. There were notes that would be wrong on music theory, but he just changed the theory and he just moved it ahead. Well, Charlie Parker wasn't quite like that, but Bird was such a fast player, and also rhythmically he was very advanced. He'd accent unusual notes. And the thing about him, Charlie Parker, though, is he was a little more accessible than some of the other players because he had a very blues-oriented background. So you could hear the blues in what he was playing, even when he was playing something that was extremely advanced.
And Gillespie was at about the same time, and they, of course, played together quite a bit, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. During certain periods of time, they played a lot, especially in the mid-40s. And in a way, it's almost an odd couple because you could see where Charlie Parker and, say, the young Miles Davis, who was a much more melodic player, they fit together pretty well. But when it was Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie, it was almost like they were battling each other because they inspired each other to just play such heated and explosive solos. Because Dizzy Gillespie, he played such radical ideas for 1945, and you compare him to someone like Harry James, and it's like 20 years ahead of him.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, bebop was a group effort. I think in retrospect, Parker gets a tremendous amount of the credit for it, maybe because it's easier to put one person with a breakthrough. But who are some of the other important people in the birth and growth of bebop, Scott?
Well, that
you already said Gillespie.
Yeah, Bird and Diz, Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie. But there were others, and what was in retrospect, you could really look at it and say, well, the function of the rhythm section changed quite a bit, and a lot of it was due to pianist Bud Powell. I mean, he came up with a completely fresh and new way of playing piano, and that basically was the way that the piano was played in jazz for the next 15 years, at least until, the early 60s with McCoy Tyner and Bill Evans. But until then, pretty much all the young players that came up who were playing modern jazz sounded very much like Bud Powell. So he completely changed the role of the piano, and by doing that, it changed the role of the bass and the drums, too. What he did on the piano was, instead of having the piano be a timekeeping, almost a one-man band, which is what it was when stride pianists in the 30s and 20s were playing, in his case, his right hand would play lines, single-note lines quite often that were sort of like a horn player, while his left hand, instead of keeping time, would hit rhythms. And it would almost sound like a drummer playing bass drum, really, in that he would just accent unusual spots by hitting chords here and there, but he wasn't necessarily keeping time that way.
Mm-hmm. And he was actually playing differently.
Yeah, it was much different than, say, Eddie Wilson or Count Basie or Fats Waller or anybody that came before him, because the left hand was no longer keeping time. It was just accents. And because of that, the string bass became essential in small groups, in any kind of jazz group, because the bass was keeping time instead of the piano.
Mm-hmm.
While the drummer, instead of keeping time, the drummer kept time, but he also accented things at unusual spots too, just like the piano's left hand. So it changed the way that jazz sounded, really. So I'd say Bud Powell, very high up there, and Thelonious Monk was up there, even though he's kind of a separate from bebop. He came up at the same time, but he had his own way of playing and his own large repertoire of great songs that he wrote. And drummer wise, Kenny Clarke was probably the first one to change the accent from the bass drum to the snare drum and then to the hi-hat. And Max Roach was quite innovative, and he took it from Kenny Clarke and moved it forward. So those would be the main ones, I think. And then there are others that came up, like Bats Navarro, a great trumpeter, and Miles Davis eventually after that. And J.J. Johnson kind of saved the trombone in a way, because for a little while it looked like the trombone was going to be lost and become a minor instrument. But J.J. Johnson found a way to play fast on it and to play the trombone in bebop. So, yes, those are among the key people anyway. There's about five or six others, I think.
Now, Charlie Parker, obviously the Charlie Parker story didn't end very happily. Could you give us the thumbnail of that? You know, he's apparently a fairly troubled individual, unfortunately.
Well, he was a drug addict. He was a heroin addict, and that shortened his life. And he could be a little extreme in his appetites in various levels. So he drank an awful lot, too. I think alcohol did as much to kill him. So he only made it to the age of 34. He did an awful lot during that time period. And it would have been very interesting to see what he, if he had taken better care of himself, it would have been really fascinating to see what he would have done in the next 10 years. Because he, by 1952, 53, he was kind of bored with bebop. He'd been playing the same tunes, most of them, for the last 6 or 7 years. But he hadn't quite figured out what to do next. Mm-hmm. Now, if he had teamed up with such people as, say, Charles Mingus, when Mingus, a few years later, had his bands and Gil Evans, and then eventually people like Ornette Coleman and John Coltrane, it would have been fascinating to see how he would have reacted to all that.
Mm-hmm. To sum up, Parker, where would you put him, Scott, in the kind of the pantheon of American music? Where would you? It's kind of easy with Louis Armstrong and some other people, but where would you put Parker?
Well, to me, there's six people who, in jazz history, that are just up in the clouds, really. Their accomplishments are so huge that you really can't compare them to anybody else, because not only the way they played, but their influence and just their pure originality. And to me, those six are Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, Miles Davis, and John Coltrane.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all six of them completely changed jazz to a certain extent. And among saxophonists, I mean, other than possibly John Coltrane, there's really nobody on Charlie Parker's level. He just for pure playing, I mean, some of his solos are just incredible, the things he comes up with on the spot. He'll come up with five great choruses, one after the other, full of fresh ideas and unusual twists and turns and things that are almost impossible to play unless you really study them. And he just made it up on the spot. So he... You know, if someone says that he's the greatest saxophonist of all time, I wouldn't argue. There are a few others that can be on the same level, but I don't think anybody was better.
Mm-hmm. Now, the original reaction to bebop was not great. I know that Louis Armstrong had some funny but pointed things to say about it, and I understand that those things got settled, and actually he ended up being great friends with Dizzy Gillespie. What was the initial reaction, and how did that all get kind of solved?
Well, the problem with bebop is that the timing was a little bit off, and that there was a musicians' recording strike, which kept most union musicians off records during all of 1943, and actually the second half of 42 and into 44. Some people were off records for 2.5 years, and until their labels happened to settle with the musicians' union. So because of that, there really weren't that many examples of early bebop. You know, the music suddenly came up full force on records in 1945, and when people who were much more familiar with Glenn Miller and Tommy Dorsey and Harry James, when suddenly they heard Dizzy Gillespie, it wasn't even a question of whether bebop was jazz. They were even wondering whether it was music at all.
Right.
It was just so radical at the time. Now, after a few years, they got a little more used to it, and bop became part of the mainstream of music. But when it first came up, the reactions were very much against it by many people, because they were used to dancing the swing bands. They could have danced the bebop, but there were reasons why, including an entertainment tax that discouraged clubs from having dancing. There were a variety of reasons why bebop wasn't really being danced to, but it could have been. And I thought that was a mistake for the music, really. getting rid of the dance floors and having it be people have to go and listen to the music without, you know, it lost part of the audience because of that.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. It's very interesting. And what came after bebop? We're talking about kind of the birth of bebop. I know there's hard bop and there's various things, and it keeps going, obviously. What sort of followed?
Well, because of Dizzy Gillespie, who was a great teacher, and because the music itself was gradually being used by arrangers of all types of music, bebop became part of American music and part of the mainstream. So the next two types of jazz that came out of it were both pretty bop-oriented and were not really radical changes from it. I mean, there was cool jazz, which was a quieter version in general that was based partly on the West Coast, where the rhythm section was a lot smoother and the music was a little more melodic, but they still played solos that were basically from bop. Cool jazz, say Jerry Mulligan, Chet Baker, that kind of music was particularly popular in the early to mid-50s. And then after that, hard bop came up on the East Coast. And that was essentially an extension of bebop. It was partly different because LPs were now being recorded instead of 78, so the performances were longer, and the rhythm section was a bit looser. They weren't as restricted as before. There were more bass solos and more dancing bass lines instead of just playing 1, 2, 3, 4 all the time. But, you know, if you listen to someone like Lee Morgan or even early Freddie Hubbard, it's not really that far different than Dizzy Gillespie and Fats Navarro and Miles from the 40s. Jazz didn't really move greatly forward until the avant-garde or free jazz came up, and that's different altogether. You know, it came up in the late 50s.
Maybe that's our next conversation.
Yeah, but that's like the next great jump forward, really. You know, you start with 20s jazz, and then you go to bebop, and then you go to free jazz, you know. And the other movements in between, including swing, were logical developments that were kind of gradual, as opposed to giant steps forward.
Beautiful. Scott, as always, I tremendously appreciate this. Can you give the URL of your site again?
Oh, sure. Well, my website is www.scottyanow.com. And,
right.
Yeah, I always like getting emails and like hearing from people about the music, you know, because one thing I always like to emphasize is that jazz ended its golden age around 1920 when records became widely available, and it's still in its golden age. You know, one might talk about, oh, the audience isn't that big and all that, but if you're just looking at the music from the quality standpoint, the artistic, there are just so many great musicians around right now, and there's just so much really good music to hear. And I always advise people to go out and see the music live, because as good as the records are, when you see them live, you get to watch them react to each other, and you get to see them make fresh new music.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's a great lesson. I appreciate that, Scott.
I love it anyway. I haven't been bored since I discovered it.
Thanks very much. And this, again, is the Daily Music Break at www.dailymusicbreak.com. Thank you very much for listening. Stop by the site. Listen to Scott's other podcast we did with Scott and Louis Armstrong and hear some great music and hear some other experts talk about what they're doing or what they've studied. And thank you very much. This is Carl Wanchek for the Daily Music Break. Bye-bye.